On the eve of the Great Strike of 1877, there was widespread hostility, not just in Albany, but in scores of cities that experienced the same or similar things that Albany had. That leads me to the Great Strike, the last section of my talk. The July 1877 railroad workers' strike occurred within the context of the hazardous intersection between railroad tracks and trains in city streets, and consequently the ongoing struggles between railroads and a variety of urban residents. What became the Great Strike, as it was called by contemporaries, started in Baltimore, Maryland on the 18th of July. Railroad workers there went out on strike over a recent pay cut. And of course, you have to keep in mind that in 1877, the United States was still in the Depression of 1873, a depression that really didn't end until the end of the decade. So the railroad workers were not at all happy over a 10% pay cut. They went on strike over that, as well as their right to bargain collectively. Their strike, however, quickly spread to other cities and towns. In other words, the strike spread to other railroad workers in different towns. But just as quickly, the strike involved urban residents who were not railroad workers, urban residents who began to stop trains in city streets, attack railroad property, engage in pitched battles with the police, and so on and so forth. And these are the folks who, I assert, engaged in these kinds of behavior precisely because of the hostility that the railroads had engendered in their communities as a result of running tracks and trains right through crowded neighborhoods. But to return to Albany, right? And the start of what becomes the Great Strike. And it becomes the Great Strike precisely because of all of these urban residents who are unconnected to the railroad joining, sort of pouring out into the street and beginning a sort of free-for-all in terms of attacking railroad property and attacking railroad interests. Well, as soon as the strike started in Baltimore on the 18th, the people of Albany, like the people of Syracuse and the people of Buffalo and many other communities, they almost immediately began to speculate on what would happen in their city, what's going to happen, especially as they learned of the strike in places like Buffalo and Hornellsville, the strike in Buffalo beginning on the 21st, the Saturday, and especially as they learned that the strike quite often brought with it considerable violence. While there was considerable speculation about what might happen, there was a great deal of speculation, much of it contradictory in the Albany newspapers. Albany state and railroad authorities were taking no chances. They began to prepare for a strike of railroad workers and the possibility of widespread anti-railroad violence. On Sunday the 22nd, the militia commenced its mobilization and was stationed at various points in the city. In addition to two bridges spanning the Hudson River and linking Albany to East Albany, were occupied by troops. In doing so, authorities hoped to divide the railroad workforce because there were significant numbers of railroad workers who lived in East Albany, a community, by the way, which had also seen serious conflicts between railroad companies and various residents and groups over their use of the streets. Equally important, authorities, I think, hoped to separate just in general all of the residents of Albany and East Albany. The Albany strike itself started on Tuesday morning, the 24th, at the New York Central's immense rail facility in West Albany, as it was called. This facility was about 2 miles from the city's center. As the railroad workers' strike began, military forces continued to pour into Albany. Despite the opposition of local officials, especially the mayor, who at this time was Mayor Banks, A. Bleecker Banks. And in fact, Banks took to the city's newspapers to expresses confidence in the people of Albany. Yet he also expressed worry that despite his confidence in the working men and women of the city, violence might erupt, as it had in other cities. He was particularly worried about people who might gather in the streets, the same place, of course, that was the nexus of conflict between people and railroads in general. So Banks advised all citizens to abstain from collecting in crowds, which I thought was a rather remarkable admission or admonition on his part. His plea to the community, especially his attempt to dissuade people from gathering in streets lest they turn into dangerous crowds, stemmed from an awareness that there was a good deal of hearty sympathy, as a newspaper put it, with the strikers in the city. The mayor was also well aware, as were all political leaders in Albany, of the widespread hostility among many in Albany toward the railroads, given the conflicts at, for example, the Broadway Crossing and Quay Street and Steamboat Square. The railroad, they knew full well that the railroad's injurious intersection with streets and neighborhoods had killed and injured people with appalling regularity. Passing locomotives set homes on fire. The noise of locomotives frightened horses, causing innumerable runaways, some of which ended in injury to people and property. And of course, merchants and small property owners opposed the disruption caused to their businesses by the railroad's use of city streets. As a result of such injuries and conflicts, people were prone to join crowds and assault the interests of the railroads. That had happened already in places like Buffalo, and I think the mayor was well aware of that fact. That it happened in Baltimore, it had happened in Pittsburgh. As the Albany Evening Times, I think, put it quite succinctly, quote, "The danger lays in crowds, keep away from them," end quote. Well, the striking railroad workers themselves quickly learned the extent to which people who were not railroad workers harbored hostility toward the railroad companies, their employers. From the very start of their strike, they had to deal with the issue of people who were not railroad workers wanting to intrude on their proceedings. Many railroad workers did not want outsiders, like dry goods clerks, for example, to participate in any way, shape, or form in the strike. Other railroad workers welcomed their participation. There were many episodes in Albany during its unique version of the Great Strike, so I will but relay the biggest event of that disorderly week, and then very briefly note a couple of smaller incidents. On late Tuesday afternoon, which was really day one of the strike in Albany, between 800 to 1,000 people gathered in the Capitol Park in central Albany. This meeting was planned by the striking railroad workers, but it included many strike sympathizers and urban residents who had their own reasons for wanting to strike out at the railroads, perhaps because one of their neighbors had been killed or injured at a railroad crossing, or perhaps because they were a small business that had been adversely impacted or perhaps even put out of business given the laying of railroad tracks in the street upon which their business was located. The Evening Times observed about this gathering in the Capitol Park that while the gathering contained railroad workers, quote, "many more were idlers drawn to the spot by curiosity or sympathy with the movement." The Albany Argus, while foregoing the idler pejorative, agreed that the crowd was, quote, "very scantily sprinkled with railroad employees," end quote. This group quickly became a crowd and decided to move against railroad property. And so they began to move down State Street. Once the crowd reached the intersection of State and Broadway, it followed the railroad tracks to the freight houses of the Delaware and Hudson Canal Company, the same company that had tried to lay additional tracks on Steamboat Square. May have been just a coincidence, I don't know. Railroad workers, in any event, railroad workers at the freight houses of the Delaware and Hudson, railroad workers who were there and who were at work were forced to stop work. The crowd then proceeded to a railroad roundhouse on Lumber Street, compelling a group of machinists and other workers, merely by their presence, to stop work. One rather old employee, however, strenuously objected to having to quit work. As he put it, he would gladly quit work in a show of sympathy for the striking railroad men, but given that the crowd seemed to consist mostly of people who had no connection to the railroads at all, he felt quite put upon. In addition to closing the Lumber Street roundhouse, the crowd spiked some railroad switches on the tracks running into and out of the roundhouse. That meant, among other things, of course, that no trains would be leaving or entering the roundhouse, nor would they be crossing through neighborhood streets, at least not for a while. This crowd then proceeded to cross the upper bridge over the Hudson River into East Albany. The troops assigned to guard that bridge, well, we're not really quite sure what happened to them. I think the sight of a 1,000-strong mob decided that perhaps they should decide to fight another day. They apparently disappeared. And so the crowd crosses over, and once in East Albany, the crowd began to stop trains. This crowd continued to spike switches. In fact, people removed entire rails and just started walking off with them. It was commented upon by many railroad workers, and it was commented upon by newspaper observers that many of the switches had been spiked in a very sloppy and inefficient way, which many took to indicate that many of the people in the crowds were not railroad workers. Anyway, this crowd continued to move through East Albany. It was moving south. As it did so, it nearly doubled in size to about 2,000 people. This crowd was drawing both railroad workers and non-railroad people, if that's not too awkward a term, who had their own grievances against the railroads. People began carrying off entire switching mechanisms, leaving some lines impassable. Upon reaching the lower bridge across the Hudson, the crowd encountered yet another train. The engineer spotted the train and slowed to a stop. Not only did he not want to run over people, but he was concerned that perhaps this mob, this crowd, had somehow made the tracks upon which the train was going to travel unsafe for travel. So he got off of the train. He walked into the crowd. He spotted someone he knew, a very well-known peddler in the city of Albany. He went to him and basically asked, is there someone in charge? And we don't really know who was in charge of this crowd. But this peddler took him to one of the railroad strikers, and a conference was held, and it was decided that this train would be allowed to proceed, given that it was a passenger train, and given that it was carrying working people home after a long day of work. That train was allowed to pass, but the crowd interfered with other trains. It attacked parts of trains that were just sitting idly on the track before crossing back into Albany over the lower bridge and then basically breaking up. All told, this group of striking railroad workers and Albany residents had conducted their work, so to speak, their work of assaulting the interests of the railroad companies, over the course of about 2.5 hours. That was sort of the singular event, or one of the singular events during the strike in Albany. As Tuesday came to a close, although there were a number of very interesting episodes that took place in the West Albany rail yards, but I don't have time to talk about those. As Tuesday, day one of the strike, came to a close, and here are some of the other things that are taking place in the city. They're much less spectacular, but I think they're also significant. As Tuesday came to a close, a large crowd gathered at the Spencer Street Railroad crossing in central Albany. As a train crossed the street, it was subjected to a barrage of stones, and the same train was stoned twice afterward as it continued through the city. Passing trains at the Van Wart Street crossing were showered by stones and other projectiles. Troops that were sent to disperse that crowd were also assailed with stones. There's no, I have no information on the size of that crowd, but it had to be a fairly large one. The mayor of Albany was so concerned over the situation in the vicinity of the Broadway crossing that he persuaded the military commanders of Albany. Albany was in fact now an armed camp that was bursting with thousands of soldiers. The mayor persuaded the military not to send any more troops to what he called that locality, for as the mayor quite rightly reasoned, the sending of troops would only inflame the passions of those who formed these crowds, and for years preceding the great strike had their passions inflamed, so to speak, by the railroad's disruptive and deadly intersection with crowded city streets. The great strike, that's sort of the end of what I wanted to say about social conflicts. As for the great strike itself in Albany, that strike sputtered to an end by the close of the week as thousands of armed troops secured the bridges, finally, occupied virtually every potential trouble spot, and of course as railroad workers, desperate for a paycheck, drifted back to work. Nonetheless, prompted by the strike of railroad workers, hundreds of people in Albany, unconnected to the railroads, had, I believe, briefly but pointedly expressed their anger and hostility. Anger and hostility that had been created by the railroads' deadly intersection with their streets and their neighborhoods in the years leading up to 1877. Thank you for listening to me.